This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, the man who took on the tobacco industry, David Kessler. As the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, Kessler campaigned to have nicotine classified as a drug. In that, he failed, but Kessler and the FDA uncovered evidence that cigarette companies deliberately try to addict consumers, and that has cost tobacco big money in civil lawsuits. David Kessler served as commissioner of the FDA under Presidents George H. Bush and Bill Clinton from 1990 to 1997. He is a graduate of Amherst College, Harvard Medical School, and the University of Chicago Law School. Dr. Kessler is currently dean of the Yale University School of Medicine. He is the author of the new book, A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Dr. David Kessler this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Kessler, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Tell us about the delicate state of affairs at the FDA when you came on board in 1990, and why was it that you wanted the job?
The FDA had had a rough period of time by 1990. There was a period of about a decade of deregulation. The agency had suffered a diminution of resources. There was, in fact, a generic drug scandal that rocked the agency to the core. A few bad apples were found to be taking bribes, both within the drug industry and at FDA. So things were looking pretty bleak. I think the agency, it was questioned in every corner, on the Hill, in the public, in the media, whether the agency really was up to the job.
And so you arrive on the job. How do you try to get a handle on all that transpired and get this embattled agency back on its feet?
FDA is without a doubt the most important consumer protection agency in the world. It regulates 25 cents on every consumer dollar. Talk to anyone who's ever worked there. I mean, they love the agency's mission and believe firmly in what the agency does. We had to step up to the plate. And, you know, early on, I said something relatively simple, but it, I think, had a great deal of effect. I said we were going to enforce the nation's food and drug laws. And that, in fact, we live by that. We did it fairly and even-handedly, but we started taking actions against misleading food claims, claims in the supermarket that had been made for years, claims that you got to the point where no one could trust what the words on food labels meant. We speeded up the approval of drugs for serious and life-threatening diseases. When I came, there was one AIDS drug available. By the time I left, I think the count was up to 13. So we really speeded up the approval for drugs for serious and life-threatening diseases. And we started showing that the agency could resume its historic mission, which was protecting and promoting the public health.
Mm-hmm. A big battle was the fight over food labeling, which you say was a necessary precursor to taking on tobacco as you look back over things. Why was that fight so important?
You know, it's interesting. Some of my colleagues said that that really was the training ground. We had, in order to go on to really learn how one takes on big challenges. On the one hand, we had the Department of Agriculture and the food industry that didn't want full disclosure of what was in food products. The meat industry violently opposed to being able to label their products with how much fat, how much cholesterol in it. And FDA, on the other hand, wanting to have disclosure that could be useful to consumers. You know that little nutrition box that's found on any packaged food that's labeled Nutrition Facts, where it has total fat, cholesterol, sodium, and the percent daily value, the percent of your daily diet that's in each of those products. I mean, that little box, that Nutrition Facts, almost didn't happen. In fact, the story, it ended up in the Oval Office with President Bush Sr. there, and the Department of Agriculture, Jim Baker, Dan Quayle, Marlon Fitzwater. And I tried to figure out, how could we get the president to side with us? And I had been to a McDonald's several months earlier. And, you know, they have those placemats on the trays, those paper placemats.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I saw on one of those paper placemats that they had the Nutrition Facts panel, the Nutrition Facts information, very similar to what we were proposing. So when the Department of Agriculture said, Mr. President, FDA, you know, lost its mind, this nutrition labeling is not going to work, we took out the McDonald's placement and said, Mr. President, if it's good enough for McDonald's, it should be good enough for the Department of Agriculture. And that won the day.
Yeah. What was it like going toe-to-toe with veteran lawmaker Ed Madigan, who's from this neck of the woods?
And a wonderful man, and a thoughtful man. And I never quite understood why he was taking the position that he took on food labeling. I think in the end he just had a very large constituency in the food industry and even within the Department of Agriculture that was resisting the full disclosure on food products. I thought the world of Ed Madigan.
Hmm. It wasn't long after the food labeling battle was pretty much won that an associate commissioner by the name of Bruce Nesbitt said to you, I want to see you take on tobacco.
Yeah, it was just like that. Nesbitt came up to me and said, tobacco kills more people than any other product. It is the number one preventable cause of death. Why doesn't FDA regulate tobacco? It regulates everything that's put on the skin, everything that we ingest, all our foods, all our drugs. Why doesn't FDA regulate tobacco? I think, Kessler, you should go regulate tobacco.
And your reaction was?
I looked at him as if he was crazy. I mean, everywhere Nesbitt went, he got the same answer. You can't do that. They're too big. They're too powerful. It's a fool's errand. Yes, we agree that nicotine is a drug. But you just can't do that. It's political suicide.
You write that prior to his call for you to act on tobacco, you hadn't thought about tobacco regulation since you'd taught a law course at Columbia. And the discussion in the classroom one day was about the definition of a drug and the intent of a manufacturer.
That's exactly correct. Let me give you the definition of a drug. Just because you can look up, take any pharmacological textbook and pull it off the shelf and you'll find nicotine in that, or if you go into any medical library, into any medical database, and you type in the word nicotine, you'll find thousands of articles on nicotine's effect on the central and peripheral nervous system. Just because nicotine's in the pharmacological textbooks does not make it a drug under the terms of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act that was enacted in 1938, that is still good to this day. If you look at that definition in the law, a drug is, in relevant part, an article, except for food, intended to affect the structure or function of the body. Does nicotine affect the structure or function of the body? Of course it does. But that alone does not make it a drug. There's that word intended, an article intended to affect the structure or function of the body. Ask a tobacco company, what do you intend? And they say, nicotine's just in the plant. It's there for taste. It's there for satisfaction. We don't intend nicotine's effect on the structure or function of the body. So in essence, because of that definition, because of that word intended, which generally was interpreted by the courts to mean the manufacturer's intent, we had to go where no one else had ever gone before. inside the industry to begin to understand what the companies knew, what did they do with nicotine.
Also, as part of that classroom discussion, a student asked, had tobacco gone unregulated because of the tobacco lobby? And you said, no, I don't think so. But your co-teacher, Hal Edgar, had other ideas. Tell us a little bit about that exchange.
Well, you know, the best, you know, I'm at Yale now, and it's true, whether you're at the University of Illinois or you're at Yale, and the students just cut to the chase. I mean, they said, look, I mean, the reason this is not a drug is because FDA is just reluctant to regulate it as a drug. That's the reason it's not a drug. And I didn't, I mean, very honestly, I didn't understand coming into the job, or even early on, the extent of the power of the tobacco industry. I thought that no one believed them. I thought they just didn't have much credibility. But, you know, in fact, they got the Congress to cut our appropriations when we wanted a new headquarters facility. They got the Congress to end up investigating us. There was even a memo when I was researching the book called, there was a strategy called Operation Rainmaker, whereby Philip Morris wanted to go by certain media outlets, including UPI, to be able to control the press. They had former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher on the payroll, former Senator Howard Baker working for them. They had a former FDA commissioner who worked for them. One congressional investigator who left his post as a chief investigator for the House Commerce Committee went immediately on retainer to the industry for $2.5 million just to be able to advise them if they ever got subpoenaed. This is an industry that thought and believed that it could buy almost anybody.
More money than God.
Well, that, you know, that line, it was fascinating. A young colleague at the FDA walked into my office one day, and she was absolutely, she was angry at me. She said, I hear you're working on tobacco, because it was really, it's only a very small group that was working on it. And while we weren't being secret, we were being relatively quiet, weren't talking about it a lot, because there was a lot of homework to do. And she says, I hear you're working on tobacco. I have to be on that team. And only later did I fully understand that I mean, her desire to work on tobacco, to be part of that team, was driven, in fact, because she was, in a previous job, she worked for a large PR firm, a public relations firm, whose largest client was Philip Morris. And she told me a story that one day in her previous job, she was working, she was walking with her boss back to their corporate headquarters, and she was talking about a project she was doing for the company. She said, don't worry, we're going to do this in a cost-effective manner. We're not going to waste any money, I promise. And her boss looked at her and said, Sharon, you don't get it. We're Philip Morris. We have more money than God.
Mm-hmm. Once you began looking into tobacco and the question of intent, you met up with a guy from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Jack Henningfield. Now, this agency was working on tobacco, and then it wasn't working on tobacco. What happened to NIDA?
Henningfield had started working on nicotine and the addictive properties of nicotine back in the early 80s. Long before I even came to the FDA, Henningfield one day gets a visit by then the drug czar under President Reagan, who comes and visits his laboratory. Henningfield explains that he's working on tobacco and the addictive properties. And then over the next short period of time, gets very clear instructions, in essence, that if he continues to do that, he will threaten the continued funding of the whole institute. lose you. I mean, even in by the 1980s, the extent of the power of the tobacco industry.
One of the wonderful things I think you've done with this book is you've shown us that some of the difficulties that federal workers, that their bureaucrats face trying to do their jobs, trying to do the right thing. And I guess it seems to me rather miraculous that some of these folks continue to work so diligently even after such an incident.
And wonderful individuals. Individuals, you know, we tend to think of them as bureaucrats and as people who are sitting there and maybe not the most productive. These are individuals who could go out, a guy like Henningfield, could go out and earn two, three, four times what he was making. He is one of the most preeminent scientists in all of addiction biology. And yet, there are people who are as dedicated, as committed. And in fact, it was one of the great things about being at the agency. You know, there was a lot of stuff thrown at us along the way. Hearings to investigate us. One of the members of our team got brought up on perjury charges. Another member got brought up on harassment charges. And, you know, in some ways, we got to the point where we so firmly believed in what we were doing. It's so important to us. None of this made any difference. None of the attacks on us deterred us. You know, I don't know how you could actually do a job like we did with everyone attacking you unless you believe in what you're doing and unless you believe passionately in what you're doing.
Mm. You mentioned perjury charges being brought against one of the folks there at the FDA, and a former congressman from our district was involved here, Tom Ewing. And in the book, you tell a story of the letter to you at the FDA being written, one of the letters being written by Ewing, and another letter into this matter being written for Ewing by tobacco.
You know, I had suspected it when I was at the agency. There were a set of letters that came to us and to the EPA, written by Tom Ewing and his colleague in the House, Charlie Rose. And we had seen certain legal documents and a request filed by the tobacco industry from us and from the EPA. And, you know, in one of those requests, it said, we want all correspondence with the Department of State, Department of Agriculture, the NSF, the NIH, and listed 20 federal agencies. And I remember seeing that legal document. And then I looked at the Ewing's letter to us, and what was striking, and Rose's letter to us, was striking that all those agencies were named in exactly the same order. I mean, if you did the math, the likelihood of coming up with the exact same order, I mean, there was virtually no chance that it was just by accident. But, you know, I only suspected it. I couldn't prove it at that time. Only later, when I was writing the book and doing more research, did I find the actual draft that went from us. Went from the lawyers for the tobacco industry into Charlie Rose and to the committee. They had drafted the letter. The Congress, you know, what individual congressmen actually knew, what Congressman Ewing knew, did he really know the tobacco industry was writing this? It's hard to believe that he didn't, that it was just some staff members. But they were just funneling through requests that the industry was making and using the Congress as a front.
Mm. I want to go back to the idea of the National Institute on Drug Abuse working on tobacco in the Reagan administration. And even earlier than that, let's go further and further back. The Surgeon General in 1964 released a report on smoking and health. Were there other agencies working on tobacco in addition to National Institute on Drug Abuse? Over all this period of time.
You know, it's a fascinating question when you think about it. It wasn't until 24 years later, in 1988, when Surgeon General C. Everett Koop issued the report about nicotine and the addictive properties. It wasn't until relatively late when we realized that nicotine really was, the scientists in the public community understood that nicotine met all the scientific criteria. You know, the department that was working on this all along was the Department of Agriculture, but they were working to be able to have farmers grow the plant, to be able to sell the plant. So there is this dichotomy, this real ambivalence that we've had even at the level of the federal government.
You put together a team to handle the investigation. When did that happen, and how many people were involved? And maybe you'd give us some idea of the range of responsibilities these folks took on.
Not the team that you would, or the set of skills that you would normally expect. Really, very few people at the core. One was a former Secret Service CIA agent. One was a polygraph expert. One was a former investigative journalist. And one was this public relations expert who had worked for one of the tobacco companies. And what we had to start doing was talking to people. Again, the whole question was determined by what did the companies know about nicotine? What did they do with nicotine? What was their research? What was their intent? What was their real intent, despite what they publicly stated? What did they know? Did they know about nicotine's addictive properties? Did they manipulate nicotine levels in cigarettes? Did they know that nicotine had pharmacological properties? So it took a team like that to go inside the tobacco industry, where no one really had ever gone before, and started talking to people who used to work at the tobacco industry.
So when did tobacco companies begin manipulating nicotine in cigarettes?
You know, it actually goes back decades. The 1952, the article in Reader's Digest, really 12 years before that 64 Surgeon General's report, when that article hit in 1952, that really spurred the development of filters being put in front of cigarette rods. But think about it. What does a filter filter out? It filters out tar. It filters out nicotine. Why do people smoke? They smoke for nicotine. So if the filter's taking out the nicotine, what do you have to do to keep people smoking? You got to increase the level of nicotine. And that's, in fact, what they did even back in the 50s. They went to certain types of tobacco leaf that had more nicotine in them. But over the years, they became more and more sophisticated. Light cigarettes, they take out the tar. They take out the nicotine. But if you let that happen, and 85% of smokers smoke light cigarettes, if you do that and you're taking out the nicotine, well, people are not going to continue smoking. So what, and I didn't realize this. We sent, if you look at the Merit cigarettes, Merit regular, Merit light, Merit ultralight, we sent them to our laboratory. Merit ultralight has the highest concentration of nicotine in it. Because if you don't increase that concentration of nicotine in there, people are not going to be able to get enough nicotine to satisfy their craving. So the manipulation actually goes back decades. Our laboratories told us one other thing that I didn't realize, because those laboratories normally measured the content of drugs, of pills. They would look at the uniformity from pill to pill to pill, and what they said, something's very striking here. The uniformity between cigarette to cigarette to cigarette in nicotine content, cigarettes are more uniform, one cigarette to the next, than the average pill is to another pill. The content was that exact.
The book, during these sections where you were reporting on nicotine and how it affects the brain and how much nicotine a cigarette needs to have in order to offer satisfaction and the filter business and all these issues, I was left wondering, those unfiltered cigarettes my father smoked in the service in the 40s, were they safer than the filter cigarettes that came along in the 50s?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, there is some data now that the lighter cigarettes, that people have to puff harder on them, and therefore that the smoke is going into the further into their lungs, down into the alveolar tracts, and that's creating additional risk. But you have to understand that the whole issue of manipulation had less to do with, you know, well, was there something evil that the tobacco companies were doing? That's not why we were interested in manipulating nicotine levels. The reason we were interested in were they manipulating nicotine levels really went to the question, if they were manipulating nicotine levels, it went to the question of intent. It went to why they were manipulating nicotine levels. If they knew they had to keep the nicotine levels up there, and they did that, then it went to their intent.
I want to go to that question of intent, but before we do that, I want to ask you just how are nicotine levels in cigarettes manipulated? How is it done?
Well, it's done many different ways. Ultimately, you know, we have seen documents where the tobacco companies know the precise dose that has to be in cigarettes of nicotine in order to satisfy a person's addiction. And they knew they could not go below that level. But there are many ways that we found. And again, I didn't know any of this when we started. The simplest way is anyone who's been on a tobacco farm knows that the leaves higher up you go on the stalk, the leaves on the top have higher concentrations of nicotine. So by having different different stalk positions and different crop varieties over different crop years, you can have almost any combination of nicotine you can choose from. But then we found, and we got a tip to check patents that were filed in foreign countries. And we found a patent that was filed in Brazil for a genetically engineered, genetically bred high nicotine tobacco plant. Here it wasn't just normal tobacco leaves being put in. But then we saw this Brazilian patent that was codenamed, the tobacco was actually codenamed Y1. We had an informant. And that genetically engineered tobacco had 6% nicotine, twice the level of normal flu-cured tobacco. But all we had was evidence of a patent. When they asked, the companies were asked, you know, they said they weren't using that in American cigarettes. And we traced, I mean, it really was a real-life detective story, because we traced one of the names on the patent to an individual at a small genetic engineering firm in New Jersey. And she told us that she had been down to Brazil and had seen some of these plants growing in the fields. But again, that didn't mean that they were actually being used in American cigarettes. I mean, only when we sent one of our investigators up and down the ports of call in the southeast United States. I mean, you think about how many entries a day, and there are millions of entries every day into the United States. And we were going through all these manifests, literally millions of pages. And there on page 25, on one manifest, out of millions of manifests, we saw, I remember when he called me, it was a bill of lading from Sousa Cruz overseas through the Grand Cayman Islands to Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company. And there it was. It said, your order, Project Y1. And the first invoice we saw was for £500,000. And then we saw six other invoices for a total of £6.5 million. And when confronted with the evidence, Brown & Williamson admitted that, in fact, it had been using genetically bred, genetically engineered high nicotine tobacco in five varieties of American cigarettes in order to keep the nicotine levels up so that people would, in essence, continue smoking.
David Kessler is our guest here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We're talking with him about his fight with tobacco. David Kessler is the author of A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go first to a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Line one.
That's you.
Hello, Mr. Kessler. You're talking about nicotine as a drug which changes the structure and function of the brain. I was wondering if you could compare that to another kind of drug, something like Zyban, whom a friend of mine says changes the structure of the brain. How would you compare these two drugs if one is used for two purposes, one to help people to in smoking cessation, and the other one, it's marked under the name of Wellbutrin as an antidepressant.
I think the caller makes a very important point. In fact, both nicotine and Zyban meet, at least in my sense, they meet the definition of a drug. They both act directly on the central nervous system. They both act on the receptors of the central nervous system. We're learning much more about the molecular biology of these substances, and I think there's no question that both have direct actions on the brain. You know, when first raised about nicotine, and I didn't even understand it, the companies kept on saying publicly, look, nicotine's in there for the taste. It's in there for the flavor. It's there just to give satisfaction. You know, I mean, I actually, for quite a while, I believed them. The fact is that these substances have direct action on the brain, and we're learning a lot more on exactly how they interact with those nerve cells.
Yes, but someone might say that, well, I wouldn't want to use Zyban as a smoking cessation because it's like nicotine, or it might have, you know, negative effects, but it's being marketed as something to help you to stop smoking. Why is it, or how is it, that Zyban is considered, you know, a positive medical use type of drug? I mean, can it have addictive effects, or why is it that people are able to stop Zyban along with nicotine?
You know, it's a very important question. The way it affects those nerve cells, it has a little different effect than the nicotine. But it's not the nicotine in and of itself that's necessarily the problem. The problem with nicotine when you smoke is that there's 4,000 other chemicals, and those chemicals are in some way the baggage that comes along with the nicotine. So yes, there's no question that nicotine nasal spray, nicotine patch, nicotine gum, those act directly the same way as nicotine. Their route of administration is different, and in fact, people do become addicted to the nicotine gum. The problem isn't the addiction itself; it's what does that addiction carry along with it, and how detrimental it is. And in cigarettes, it's all those other chemicals that also have a very negative effect.
Mm-hmm. But would you then think that Zyban, as a drug that's put out for to treat an illness, so to speak, an addiction to nicotine, that has an effect, a positive effect, and it's not supposed to have a long-term addictive effect?
I think there's increasingly the good news is that there are a number of agents, the patch, the gum, the inhalers, the Zyban-like chemicals, that are good tools to use to stop smoking. And when compared to smoking, the risks of these products, I mean, are far less. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there is no such thing, I mean, as any product or any drug that affects the central nervous system that is without any risk.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. We're going to go next to a caller in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Hi. I had two questions. One was in relation to a incident that happened in the Chicago papers fairly recently. A doctor has a column there, and he he was talking about how it's possible if you don't have insurance to get low-cost drugs from, for example, Mexico. And he gave out a number, and he said if you just fax them a prescription, you can get exactly the same drugs that you would at your local pharmacist, but maybe at 40% of the cost you would here. And, and then about a month later, the place that he had cited in his article went out of business, and the FDA said that it was going to stop all such shipments because it wasn't sure, apparently, that they were the same drugs we were taking here or something like that. Obviously, this is all, obviously the drug companies had put the kibosh on all this. But I was wondering if you could, could tell me a little bit about what was really going on here, if you had kind of a story to tell about this at all.
I think it's a very important issue that you raise. We do know that pharmaceutical companies sell drugs throughout the world at different prices. And sometimes they're the same drug, but I think the FDA is right that certain times there are counterfeit drugs, there are inferior drugs that are made in other parts of the world that I would have great hesitancy in using, certainly for my family. Look, I worked very hard to speed up the drug approval process, to be able to get important drugs to people who needed them for serious and life-threatening conditions. But what good is that? I mean, if people can't afford those drugs. So there's a part of me that for people who can't afford drugs, and if they're facing a serious and life-threatening condition, I could understand the urge to go to Mexico or somewhere else to be able to get something that helps my family. I mean, I would do it if I had no other choice. I mean, that's why prescription drug insurance coverage, certainly for people who can't afford important medicines, is so critical. I'd much rather have that kind of system than have people flocking to Mexico where no one knows the quality. Some of that drug may be the same, it may be okay, but some of it may be inferior and put people at risk. We still have a lot of work to do when it comes to drug coverage and the uninsured.
Well, I know there are a lot of expatriates who apparently are doing fine in Mexico and in the medical system, but I wanted to ask one more question, then I'll let off. This is kind of a broad question. I was just kind of curious because it's such a mass of regulation involving food and drugs, and I was just curious if, now that you've had a little vacation, if you were back in charge of the FDA, where do you think the place most wanting for what area do you think is most wanting for reform or for looking at
priorities?
Yes. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
I think one of the hardest issues to deal with is the whole question of food safety. We have the safest food supply in the world. Thankful to a lot of people in this country. A lot of farmers, who listen, to your show. There's no doubt that we have made major inroads in food safety over the last 100 years. But today we're dealing in this global economy with products that are coming into this country. No longer does FDA have to worry about, no longer does FDA have to worry about, what's in Illinois, what the water supply is that's used to irrigate the fields in Illinois, but what's the water supply used in Chile, or in China? Products are coming from all over the world into our borders. We've done a remarkable job whether it's BSC, foot and mouth disease, we are preeminent in the world. But with the globalization, I mean, of our economy, with the fact that we are using more and more foods, that we're eating healthier, we're eating more and more vegetables, fruits and vegetables. They are uncooked. We're consuming increased numbers of packaged foods that are processed elsewhere. They're real challenges. And I think the most important thing is to make sure that those agencies, Department of Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration, have the resources. So much is dependent on it. You know, on the average, you know, we talk about regulation and trying to get government off the backs of business. And I think when that comes to finances and other aspects, it's fine. But when it comes to health and safety, I mean, there is a real job that agencies like FDA and Department of Agriculture have to do. And I think the American people expect it.
I'm really sorry we don't have more time. We're really growing short here on the time that we can spend together today.
It's been fascinating to be with you,
Dr. Gessler. But before we go, and I've got callers, I think I'm just going to have to say we're not going to be able to get to their calls today. But because before we go, I want you to talk about your thinking on regulation in tobacco. Today you want tobacco not nicotine regulated as a drug, but tobacco completely spun off from corporate parents. How would that work?
You know, it's interesting. We worked for close to a decade. We didn't, as you mentioned earlier, we lost in the Supreme Court by one vote. It was 5-4, the same as in the recent electoral case. We haven't gotten the Congress to act. What's fascinating now is the tobacco companies. Look at the Wall Street Journal last week. Philip Morris calls for federal regulation by the FDA of tobacco. I was in Kentucky 2 weeks ago, and the head of the Kentucky Burley Growers Association came up to me and said that he was now in favor of FDA regulating tobacco. Who would have ever thought, I mean, that anything like that would be said by the tobacco companies or the tobacco farmers? Look, facing enormous liability, there's a case in Florida, $146 billion against the tobacco companies. Now we know what they've known for decades. I mean, it's all out in the public domain. Despite what they have said publicly, we now know what they privately knew, that nicotine, and they knew it for decades, that nicotine was an addictive drug. So the fact is, if you are a major American corporation today and you own a tobacco subsidiary, you own a liability. Every cigarette that you sell is only going to increase your liability. So in some ways, it's not going to be FDA that's going to be calling for this, but it's going to be the tobacco companies themselves. They are, in fact, they have to, I think, in the long run. You can't be a major American corporation and own and sell cigarettes. You will put all the rest of your assets in jeopardy. So you're going to have to, in some ways, you're going to have to figure out how to spin those off, and you're going to have to want to get out of the business. And I think when that happens, what's very important is, and I didn't realize this, I certainly didn't start off this way, it's very important. Nicotine is going to have to continue to be made available. Prohibition will not work. Cigarettes are going to continue to have to be made available. But I think it's time to take the profits out of the sale of a product, certainly of a product that is addictive, through which children are becoming addictive. Until we are willing to take the profit out of these companies, I don't think we're going to make the kind of inroads. But I think it's going to end up, surprisingly, the tobacco companies are going to have to do it themselves.
Interesting. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. It's been fascinating.
Same here.
David Kessler has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He was the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under Presidents George H. Bush and Bill Clinton from 1990 to 1997. He is currently dean of the Yale University School of Medicine, and he is the author of the new book, A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry. The book is very interesting. It's published by Public Affairs.